Hello and welcome to another news episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital money and digital assets and helps you understand how digital money and assets will evolve in the future. I'm co-host Jonas, and today it's time for another news episode. We are back reviewing the news from the month May. And today I'm joined by, once again, by Maximilian Vargas from Block Stories. Max, you have been here quite some times. So thanks for coming back to us and taking the time.
Yeah, thank you for repeatedly inviting me.
Yeah, of course. We mentioned this to our audience already. I'm not reading a lot of newsletters, but one I do not miss, it's definitely Block Stories. So
thanks a lot.
Kudos again to you to you and the team. And what will we cover today? We will look once again at all things stablecoins. So when we identified the most relevant news this month, we have really seen that there is a pattern ongoing really key news are around stablecoins. So for these reasons, we decided to really focus on stablecoins today. We first start with some kind of an industry update on major stablecoin news. Qivalis has actually extended their consortium by 25 banks across Europe, which is a pretty impressive move, something we want to dive a little bit deeper on and discuss. Then AllUnity, another European stablecoin consortia, has also announced basically launch of a new stablecoin and also of some new capabilities around agentic payments, also more in a second. And we also look a little bit more on the policymakers' public sector side. The ECB, in particular, President Christine Lagarde, has put down a few remarks on stablecoins that were or sound a little bit bearish, something we also want to digest and see where this is coming from and what we think about it. And then we also look at the upcoming markets and crypto assets consultation by the European Commission. And last but not least, we take a look to the United States with the Clarity Act, where we have an update which we think is very relevant to share. But let's start with a very quick market overview and where we stand after this month. So this month, we have basically seen in Bitcoin roughly 9% drop. We are currently standing when we record at 73,000 euros for Bitcoin. Quite interestingly, even we have seen this drop, there was an increase in the Bitcoin ETF's asset under management, which are a little bit more than 106 billion at this point. When we look into Ethereum, there was an even further drop at the end of the month, roughly $2,000 for one ETH. And was very interesting because there were also some, interesting senior and important people that left the Ethereum Foundation. And there was also a tweet by Vitalik by basically kind of saying that the Ethereum Foundation wants to focus more on its core topics, such as privacy, security, open source, censorship resistance. So this announcement, at least from the market, was then, not seen very positively, but I guess we will see in over time what this will mean for the whole industry and also for Ethereum. And this was in a month where other asset classes kind of behaved a little bit differently. So MSCI World increased a little by 3%, gold declined by 3% compared to other asset classes. Not a very bullish month for Bitcoin. When you look, of course, at a lot of different indicators, and we don't want to focus too much on the price because that's also typically what we're not doing in the podcast, but it seems that the sentiment is rather bearish, and often people really talk about bear markets as well. Would be really interested, Max, what you think about it, because you are currently also hosting various different events across Europe around blockchain, crypto, institutional adoption of blockchain. Like, what is your feeling currently on the market? Like, are we in a bear market? Does it feel like a bear market, or should we just not look at the prices and do our stuff rather like that?
Yeah, it's always the question, right? Where are we currently in the market? And I think what's been true for now over 12 months, 18 months, is that there's very obviously a decoupling of like prices and adoption. So we've seen very clearly the institutional adoption only going into one direction, and it's up and to the right. But then we've seen prices now for quite some time suppressed, basically. And I think there's like both a macro conversation about it and a micro conversation. So you could obviously talk all about the different risk factors that are currently priced in broader markets, especially when it comes to geopolitics and I guess the overall outlook by Fed and other central banks when it comes to inflation and how you basically react to that from a monetary perspective. So this is something, I guess, that has been true now for many years already, that it's not like the most favorable like macro environment. But then there's also the micro debate on where do like the next incremental flows come from when it comes to crypto assets. And then you can go into various different debates. You could discuss like the quantum computing headwind for Bitcoin. You could talk about Ethereum's tough situation currently with rising competition and then not a super clear level of leadership. You could talk about like the overhang by DATS and the risk they present in the market as the MicroStrategy copycats and MicroStrategy themselves did not fly as they did like in the very first innings. So many different things, I guess, to look at. I guess in the end, it comes down to retail having left for quite some time now, and institutional capital slowly coming in, but maybe also not too comfortable to still invest like at the elevated valuations that we currently look at when you look at the crypto markets. So these assets are still like highly priced in a way when you look at FTVs and market caps of Solana, Ethereum, and others. What I do find interesting, and I guess this is also like a very positive sign of the maturation of the market, is that you see a new breed of, I guess, quality assets rise, basically. So in the past, what you've seen is whenever there was like a rotation or some short-term bullish sentiment, you could see like the broader crypto market rise like simultaneously. What you see now is that some crypto assets, I guess, benefit more than others. So if you take a look at Hyperliquid, for instance, or if you take a look at certain privacy coins, so these are like assets that have like most recently seen a lot of interest, whereas the other markets stayed suppressed or even faced more headwinds. So this is interesting. This is what we take a look at to understand the maturation of market structure and what we think is very healthy for the market.
Yeah, and it's super, super crucial really to differentiate, as you did, between like more the retail side of things and the corporate side of things, right? Because within retail, if you look at a lot of indicators, like reads, sounds, and smells rather bearish. But when we look into the institutional side, like tokenization, stablecoins, I think in every single stablecoins, I don't know, for a year or 1.5, the key topics were, like on the news episodes, were on stablecoins. So we do see progress. And even that today we solely talk about stablecoins shows also the progress here. And I guess stablecoins in Europe at least means a lot on currently a lot, I would at least say, corporate fantasy. So also more on the business side. But of course, if you look at developing and emerging economies, there is also a lot of stuff happening around stablecoins on the retail side, which may often be a little bit outside our scope, because for us in Europe, the markets are pretty efficient, right? So we may not, may need them here in a, very urgent way, as maybe in other countries and other jurisdictions.
And I think both things can be true. You can be like super positive and optimistic about the adoption of the technology and be more neutral or even like bearish on current crypto asset prices. So there is no contradiction. Both can be true.
Absolutely. And let's dive a little bit deeper now into stablecoins, because there have been, Europe again, once more, a lot of interesting news. And I didn't welcome Michael in the beginning, so I of course called Michael is also here. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Jonas. Hi, Max. Yeah, I joined a bit later due to tech issues, but here I am right in time to deep dive into our stablecoin thread of the conversation today. Let's start with what is, in my view, among the more consequential European stablecoin stories of the year so far, and that's Qivalis. For listeners who haven't been following this closely, Qivalis is the consortium of European banks that was founded in December 2025, with initially 12 banks. And of May 20th of this year, they announced that 25 additional banks have joined the initiative. So we now have 37 banks from 15 European countries on board. To give you a sense of the breadth, the founding 12 included names like BNP Paribas, ING, UniCredit, Caixa Bank, Raiffeisen Bank International, and so on. And the new wave brings in ABN AMRO, Rabobank, Intensa, San Paolo, Nordea, Erste Group, Hellaba, Swedbank, and on and on. From a German perspective, as a major part of our listener base is still from Germany, what's notable is that we now have the three German banks involved: DZ Bank for the cooperative sector, DK Bank for the savings bank pillar, and Hellaba as a Landesbank. that essentially covers the major institutional pillars of the German banking system, with the conspicuous exception of Deutsche Bank. So Manu, tell us, where is Deutsche Bank and Commerzbank? And that's a story we need to come back to, definitely.
Definitely have to ask Manu that when he's back on the news episode. But what I was really impressed also, like, Max, kudos to you and your team. I think you reported even a few weeks before this was public that this extension is going to take place. So yeah, you're really good in investigation, it seems so.
Yeah, I guess the good thing also is now a consortium encompassing over like 30 entities, the number of leaks is also increasing.
Good for you and good for us.
Now, you guys may wonder why this news matters so much. Kivalis in itself is not new. The number is rising. I gave it some thought and I want to give you three reasons. First, I think it's distribution. So combined, these 37 banks have access to several hundred million customers across Europe. That is a distribution network that no fintech, no crypto native issuer can, in my opinion, replicate. The second reason is, in my opinion, credibility. When a corporate treasurer or a fund manager evaluates whether to hold a stablecoin on their balance sheet, the question of who issues is then simply not academic. A token issued from the regulated European banking sector, supervised by the Nederlandse Bank, with reserves held under MiCA's strict requirements, is really a different proposition than something issued out of Salvador out of a small company. And third, and this is something BlockStories actually reported and I find quite telling, the funding base. If the founding banks contributed roughly 3 million euros each and the new entrants 4 million each, you arrive at roughly 136 million euros sitting in the Kivalis bank account. So this is real capital, real commitment, and it gives you the project a runaway that, frankly, most stablecoin projects or startups or scale-ups can only dream of. So on status, Kivalis has its headquarters in Amsterdam and has applied for an e-money institutional license with the Dutch Central Bank, according to BlockStories again. So Max, I enjoy citing your sources. The next operational step is a tender for custodian banks, and the launch of the actual stablecoin is planned for the third quarter of this year. I think Jonas has some evidence and insights here, which means we should see something concrete in the coming month. And I hope we really do so, because so far, no launch yet.
Yeah, and I guess that will be really interesting, because on the paper, this sounds super exciting, right? I'm super impressed how many different banks they got together across Europe. Also, the funding base, you said, Mike, is, you know, you can work with, you know, 100 of millions, so you can reach something. But of course, also, it's a reality that the license is not there yet. And also, the product is not launched yet, right? So I'm sure, like, both will come for sure, but would really love to see how the launch looks like, what the first use cases will look like, if this will also be similar on what Allunity started, is rather being, you know, getting listing at exchanges and go a little bit on crypto and then later maybe expand across traditional payments, cross-border payments, etc. So yeah, I think a really, really great start and impressive to get together these folks. And now I'm really curious to see the launch and how this will develop.
Yeah, not to be too bullish here, let's not forget that several open questions really do remain. How quickly will the Dutch license be granted, for example? Or will major exchanges actually list the Kivalis stablecoin? Or will they continue to favor incumbent dollar tokens? And perhaps the most important questions, will the participating banks actively distribute the stablecoin to their corporate clients, or will they just formally participate without then really pushing it? So we've seen plenty of bank consortia in European payments history that looked impressive on paper and at the outset and then delivered very little in practice. So I'd love really to see what really does then happen in Q3. And actually, I'd love to hear what you all think on this. So is this the moment, or is this another well-funded consortium that gets stuck in committee run-through?
Yeah, I guess what has been true in the Euro stablecoin market so far is that demand hasn't missed supply in a way. So it was not like a topic of, hey, we are missing like a regulated like Euro stablecoin so far in order to see some traction and compete with the US dollar equivalents. So the story has always been that like apparently there's no strong pull factor for customers, both on the retail side and on the institutional side, to now start using Euro stablecoins in size. I do not think that just the availability at several European banks, regardless of how big they are, really changes the equation of this at the outstart. So that on a long-term basis, when like, I guess the whole tokenization space increases in size and you adopt like this kind of an instrument on the cash lag side, I think there's like lots to be optimistic about. But I guess on a more short-term and mid-term basis, even after launch, I'm still like more pessimistic or just, I guess, very curious to see if they come up with any new playbook when it comes to their go-to-market, something we have not seen from all Unity or Circle or like similar players, or whether it will be like this slow grind, I guess, to like reach a certain level of supply that also makes the whole operation like economic. So I guess this is something that also from our conversations with all these participating banks, everybody is still figuring out, and there's no clear strategy on what to really do once the stablecoin is live.
And I mean, also, if we look at that, like generally, I would say, Max, like what you describe is that it's basically to have Euro stablecoins is a necessary condition, but not a sufficient one, right? So it needs more. It needs use cases, it needs partners, it needs the ecosystem, it needs the environment to thrive from a regulatory side, or also from the policy side, right? So that's something which is currently still being shaped, and that will of course not change a lot that just the stablecoin is out there. I mean, I'm a little bit biased in the sense of that I have normally a rather bearish perspective on banking consortia, because we have seen this in Germany very often, to kind of trying to also implement, you know, let's say payment infrastructure in the last 10 years. And it never worked from my perspective, because it was really so complicated to get the governance, the alignment, people pushing into different directions. The one banking, you know, group doesn't want to talk to the others, etc. Right. So I'm rather bearish, but my feeling, and this is also what I get from the folks at Qivalis, is that they seem at least to have a very solid setup, that they have all the power, all the people involved, all the distribution power, but still can bring the speed to the table and are also not distracted in decision making by, I don't know, 37 different opinions. So that's at least what it seems. We will see how this is in practice also when something is launched and when product decisions are taking place, etc. But it seems that this is, you know, more on the consortia that still has speed, even being very, you know, large and very powerful in terms of the size of the balance sheets of the banks.
I agree with you that there is a structural gap in the European stablecoin market. So yes, today, dollar-denominated stablecoins make up over 99% of the global stablecoin market, depending on which numbers you look for. So it numbers data are 97 to 99% of the market, depending also on point in time and market valuation, of course, with Tether around $190 billion, USD around $78 billion, and the largest European stablecoin Circle's EuroC at roughly $460 million in early March 2026. However, I think Qivalis is the most critical attempt yet so far to really close that gap. So if you will, if Europe has a chance to finally catch up, this is the opportunity, because if our 37 banks don't manage to do that, who else would? At least that's the most powerful attempt so far. And the technical infrastructure is being delivered by Fireblocks, which is a sensible choice. They have proven institutional-grade tokenization, custody, and wallet infrastructure. And importantly, Qivalis is positioning itself in a very specific layer of what I'd call the European digital money stack. We need to be precise, because there's some confusion in the market, I think. For example, there is Vero, run by the European Payments Initiative, just crossed 50 million registered users in February. That's account-based money in a modern app. It's not blockchain. And then another attempt to close this gap is the digital euro from the ECB. Is central bank money for retail, essentially digital cash, with the pilot phase starting in the second half of 2027, hopefully. And an actual issuance not expected before 2029. Now, coming back to my initial argument, Qivalis sits in a third layer, programmable blockchain native commercial bank money for the tokenized economy. So these are not really competitors, they're complementary building blocks of a European financial infrastructure. So my point is, Qivalis is positioning well with the form of digital money they chose and with the firepower of 37 banks. So my point is here, this is not yet another consortium. It's a powerful one and positioning itself quite well in the money stack.
Well, I would agree, but I would also not underestimate some of the competitors. So of course, some of the, let's say single players issuing stable coins, they are also like, you know, very reputable, know what they are doing, and also like AllUnity. So we know AllUnity, the stable coins are live for a while now. They don't just have the Euro stable coin, also the Swiss stable coin, and also announced this month actually as news that a Swedish krona stable coins will be launched. So they follow, I think, a little bit a different approach than Qivalis, which is rather multi-currency and not just single currency, which also has different use cases. And obviously, I think we had almost everyone from the leadership team from AllUnity on this podcast as well. I think it's also really a super strong leadership team in terms of executing, right? So again, but I also think we will need in the end more than one. I don't think we need 100, but I think there are also different use cases for different, you know, solutions to serve. But what I also now found very interesting and also, you know, would be cool to get your perspective on that, is that also AllUnity this month did not just announce the launch of the Swedish krona stablecoin, but also the launch of agentic payment capabilities. And this, I think, is interesting because often we hear that stablecoins are, you know, so much better than traditional rails for agentic payments in the futures when AI agents will, you know, do payments on their own, right? And now they really launch capabilities. So basically want to allow European businesses to seamlessly accept, settle and monetize with AI native payments. So provide a regulated gateway for businesses to accept agentic payments and settle in their local currencies. And this is all technically powered by MX402, the open protocol. We also discussed this in the podcast before, to support with additional protocols here. So that's again interesting because this is stuff that is getting launched soon, right? While for Qivalis, it takes a little bit longer, right? This is stuff that is coming very soon. But yeah, you know, what is your general perspective on this news, or maybe also the agentic capabilities that AllUnity now announced?
I cannot really, I guess, or I do not really have like a judgment call on the agentic capabilities and like how promising this is, like from a tech and adoption standpoint. I think this is like still a super, super early market where everybody now is trying to establish their own standards and trying to figure out basically how to play and where to play. But I think what is like most telling, and this is something that has now also the comparison to Qivalis and potentially the obstacles Qivalis is facing, that I interpret the strategic move by AllUnity to become much more opinionated in their approach of what use cases to pursue, that the classic, the traditional way of just launching a stablecoin, getting listings on like various centralized exchanges, and then maybe also announce some DeFi integration in lending markets to allow for more like utility on the stablecoin, this is somewhat broken for Euro stablecoins. So I think this is like AllUnity basically seeing that it doesn't make sense to apply the traditional playbook. We have to find like our own niche, our own like maybe blue ocean even, in order to meaningfully gain traction and move this project that has now also been like live for a couple of years into an area where there's more potential for a significant uplift and also drive usage of the stablecoin. So I think it's both visionary, but also like a reaction to the little traction, like comparatively little traction the project has seen for the first 1.5 or 2 years it's been live.
Yeah, I think a bit more bullish here, maybe because I work at a technology vendor who sets all his cards on AI and agentic AI, and also in our digital currency hub product, have a strong emphasis on agentic payments. I think AllUnity is showing us the future here. AI agents can't open bank accounts really, and they cannot wait around for a SEPA transfer really as they move fast. But a regulated MiCA compliant stablecoin, I think that's really money machines can actually use, instant, programmable, and 24/7. So when they build agentic payments now on X402 and let European businesses settle straight into their bank account, you're basically looking at the bridge between AI agents and the regulated financial system. And I'm not aware of too many stablecoin issuers that have understood these intersections and boldly move into it. So I applaud this effort. Yeah. And launching a Swedish Krona stablecoin alongside it tells you they are thinking multi-currency from day one. So being multi-currency and already embracing agentic payments is to me a proof that Allunity is playing the long game, has strategic foresight, and is willing to make its technology bets, which not necessarily all tech vendors do. So my bet, in a few years, we won't even call them agentic payments. It'll just be how machines pay machines, and regulated euro and krona stablecoins will be the race underneath, as stablecoins really lend themselves to agentic payments.
So, and I really hope that we are also not talking about stablecoins, tokenized deposits and everything in 2 more years, but just have them working in the background. So like the internet, like email. So I'm saying this for years, still we are not here and still, philosophizing about it. But I really hope that this moves more in the back. So totally echo that, Michael.
It's definitely part of a broader trend also from other stablecoin issuers, that what I guess started out as the pure play of being the issuer and basically like just limiting themselves on the whole operational side of issuing a stablecoin is now expanding into how can you basically vertically integrate your services to push the market to go deeper into the value chain and establish your own capabilities of serving new emerging markets. This is what we have seen like with Circle and their various, I guess, initiatives from their own now blockchain network to their interoperability solution to also their own like wallet SDKs and so on. Tether is basically like adopting a bit different playbook, but also similar, where they take like very strategic investments along the value chain, where they also develop their own wallet SDKs and so on. So I think this is like a smart move from Allunity, just from a perspective of, okay, we recognize that it doesn't make sense to play the crowded trade in a market that hasn't proven itself for the last 2 years, the Euro stablecoin market, and how can we position ourselves like for the next use cases of stablecoins. But the question is just like, how soon will this also like take up? So machine-to-machine payments and the whole like machine economy, this has been discussed when the term agentic payments wasn't even invented yet. So I'm not too sure like here now also on the timing, like how we see this whole space take off.
Before we jump back into today's episode, a quick word about an event close to our hearts, the Point Zero Forum. An annual gathering of over 2,000 policymakers, central bankers, regulators, and industry leaders at the intersection of finance, technology, and policy. BFRR is proud media partner of the Point Zero Forum, and we'll be reporting live on site with the full co-host team. Organized by the Global Finance and Technology Network and the Swiss State Secretariat of Finance, the Point Zero Forum takes place in Zurich from 23rd to 25th June 2026. This year's lineup includes Swiss Federal Councillor Karin Keller-Sutter, Tether CEO Paolo Arduino, former crypto head of policy at Andreessen Horowitz Brian Quintens, and NVIDIA's EMEA Financial Technology Lead, Dr. Jochen Papenbrock. The agenda covers everything from AI in financial services and digital assets of stablecoins, tokenization, and the new regulatory frontier where the rules of finance are being rewritten. Come meet us in Zurich. Register at pointzeroforum.com, and as a BFRR listener, you get 30% off the full price industry pass with code BFRR2026. I repeat, BFRR2026.
Yeah, and I still remember me when I wrote one paper, I think it was in 2018, on machine-to-machine payments and stablecoins. And yeah, I mean, the reality a few years later, it's still not there yet. So I agree, Max, in terms of timing. And I think what you said before is super interesting, because you clearly see that stablecoin issuers, also Euro stablecoin issuers, want to differentiate their business model, right? So this is, as you said, how you can interpret the all unity move. But this is also interesting. And Michael, coming back to Circle's news next, Circle has its own blockchain, Arc, right? Which we discussed before. So that's also a different model with Arc and SDKs, etc. And there were also some very relevant news around Arc from Circle just in the past month.
Yeah, now we are really pivoting to the other side of the Atlantic, because while Europe is consolidating around a consortium model, at least with Kivalis, Circle is doing something genuinely strategic and, in my view, quite bold. On May 11th, Circle announced that it had raised $222 million in a pre-sale of ARC, ARC being the native token of Circle's new public blockchain. The fully diluted network valuation comes in at $3 billion. Andreessen Horowitz's A16C crypto led the round with a $75 million check, but the rest of the investor list is what tells you really what's happening here. There is BlackRock, Apollo Funds, Intercontinental Exchange, which is the parent of the New York Stock Exchange, SBI Group, Janus Henderson, Standard Chartered, Ventures, ARK Invest, and so on. So that is essentially a who's who of institutional finance buying into a stablecoin issuer's blockchain. Let's maybe briefly unpack what ARK actually is. It's a public blockchain purpose-built for institutional finance. The initial token supply is 10 million tokens. Circle holds 25% as a stakeholder. 60% goes to the network participants, that is builders, users, contributors, and 15% goes to a long-term reserve. Circle, as a 25% holder, can run validator infrastructure, generate fee revenue, and earn staking income. Jeremy Allaire, in his CNBC interview, framed this very explicitly. Circle is moving into the operating system business, in his words, into the apps business, into being what he called a broader internet platform company. Now, to me, the why behind this news is really the most fascinating part. USDC today runs primarily on Ethereum and Solana and is distributed largely through partners like Coinbase. That's a vulnerable position for Circle, in my opinion. They don't own the rails their flagship products runs on, and they share economics with their distribution partners. With ARK now, Circle is essentially going vertical. They want to own the infrastructure layer, and there's a defensive dimension here too. With the Genius Act passed in the US in July 2025, and the Clarity Act, at least expected to finally advance in the Senate Banking Committee, the regulatory floor is being set for stablecoins in the US. But that same regulatory clarity opens the door now for banks and fintechs to issue their own dollar tokens if JP Morgan, Bank of America, or Citi all roll out their own stablecoins. Suddenly, Circle's role as a third-party issuer becomes then less essential. So building ARK is partly Circle saying, even if our stablecoin gets commoditized, we want to own the infrastructure that all stablecoins run on. Yeah, and there's also a really notable structural detail here. Circle is the first publicly listed company to conduct a token pre-sale. That is, I think, an underreported significant precedent. It legitimizes on-chain capital formation as something as NYSE-listed company can do alongside traditional equity. So a last quote here again is worth repeating, beginning of quote, every company in the world over time will be tokenized, meaning your shares will be tokens, end of quote. So whether or not you agree with that statement, the fact that the CEO of a publicly listed financial institution is making it openly tells us all where this whole story is heading, I think.
I guess quite right in your analysis. I guess the two big things that are happening here is on the one side that Circle continues to look for revenue diversification and some way to basically hedge the risk of decreasing interest rate on the underlying reserves. On the other hand, they want to get independent, I guess, from Coinbase, that they have like their own revenue share agreement for many years. I think where Coinbase is also like contractually like in a strong position to enforce like ongoing capture of half of the revenues generated by Circle. And then on the broader trend here is that you see all these payments focused chains pop up, not only because they present like a big opportunity in terms of value capture of new flows, but also because these more general purpose blockchains are lacking key capabilities that you would like to see as a treasury manager or like as somebody who is like specializing in payments to have when using blockchain infrastructure. So I guess this is like the tempo from Stripe, Circle's Arc, also what we see from the Solana Foundation, who hired like a key figure from Visa to drive forward their payment capabilities to now basically upgrade existing blockchain stacks with some of these features that you just need in order to house global payments on chain.
And I guess this was really kind of bullish and super interesting news from Europe and also then from Circle on the Euro stablecoins. But remarkably, and we don't want to just talk about the positive developments or the positive views, but also the bearish views. And we got another bearish view on May 8th, which I would also like to share and discuss with you. And this was from the president of the European Central Bank, namely Christine Lagarde, who has a few, I would say, rather bearish takes on stablecoins. And I want to just briefly elaborate on the argumentation so that we can, you know, discuss why this is the case. Because, you know, we often discuss about why, which value stablecoins can add. But, you know, this angle is also at least interesting to explore. So what Christine Lagarde says that in the stablecoin debate, it mixes up basically two different things. So one is the monetary function that a stablecoin could play. And the second one is kind of the technology or settlement technology function a stablecoin could play. When we talk about the monetary function, what she means is that increasingly the market sees a way to extend the global reach of reserve currencies via stablecoins by easing basically two long-standing constraints on how currencies circulate. A is cross-border payment infrastructure. So stablecoins allow monetary value to move kind of also outside traditional banking rails, but also fewer intermediaries and lower costs. Well, she didn't agree on the lower costs, but that's at least often what is stated, right? And also the extending the currency's reach into areas where access before has declined, because normally you just have access via banks or corresponding banks in other countries. So that's the one part of the monetary function. The second one is also that stablecoins provide actually easy holdings of currency outside home jurisdictions. So I can, for example, still hold today US dollar stablecoins, other stablecoins just with a wallet, which is, of course, a lot easier than setting up a bank account or even infeasible in the most jurisdiction when I'm not a citizen. And what she basically says on the monetary function is that basically there is a challenge, because she basically says that at this point that there is some kind of, there are trade-offs ongoing. For example, when you say you use this as a monetary function, there are financial stability risks due to stablecoins. So she often refers to the case of Silicon Valley Bank and then Circle, who kind of depegged, because at least for a short period, because there's basically some stuff happening which lowers trust, and then you don't have a stable means of payment, right? So she sees that this depegging can have broad financial stability implication. That's the first one. And the first risk of stablecoins, according to her. And the second one is weaker monetary policy transmission. So if now a lot of volume moves outside the banking sector to non-bank stablecoins, this could obviously also weak lending and also the effectiveness of the ECB's monetary policy, right? Because the ECB sets interest rates for typically loans and deposits on the bank side. But if now a lot of business moves outside banks, then the monetary policy is less effective, right? So what do you think on this monetary side? Like, do you agree with Ms. Lagarde's assessment for and risks around stablecoins?
So Lagarde's May 8th speech, I think her framing is actually useful. She splits stablecoins into two things, as you explained, Jonas, the monetary function and the technology function. On the tech side, she's really fully on board, I felt. Atomic settlement and tokenization, all of it. I think she understood it. She's fully on board. On the monetary side, she is pretty clear. Euro stablecoins, in her view, cause more problems than they solve. At least that's the sentiment I drew from that very speech. Honestly, none of that surprised me. It's the perspective a central bank kind of has to have. What I miss in her argument is the synthetic CBDC angle, which I still deem promising. So a stablecoin fully backed by central bank reserves, that would address pretty much every concern she raised, and you'd still get the programmability she actually likes in her technology functional part of her speech. So my small take here is it's a fair diagnosis, but it's a narrow menu of solutions in her speech. So giving regulated issuers access to ECB reserves could get us there faster than waiting on Pontes and Appia, for example.
I also agree that this is just very much in line with what she's been saying for all these years. I think it's also in line with what you expect her to say. I think what she doesn't say, and I also don't know if this is something that she should have in mind, but what I'm generally lacking from like policymakers and authorities in general is also having or seeing the perspective of the broader consumer benefit. So this is always about like, this is always very risk averse and very much about stability, which is obviously important, but there's also like a huge potential in order to drive welfare by increasing competition and putting more money back into the pockets of the consumer and putting us, I guess, also banks in a position where they might not have to, or where they might cannot internalize too much of their own profits and think about ways to also give something back to the consumer. And this is, I think, something that is under-discussed and something that is also positive about stablecoins, that now banks need to transform, now need to digitalize and just compete with emerging forms of fintechs.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I do see somehow agree from a central bank perspective on this monetary policy transmission argument, because if you're central bankers, you are concerned if money is moving outside the banking sector and you particularly try to steer banking rates via your decision. So I get that point. With the depegging, I'm always a little bit surprised because we do have the MiCA regulation. There is also, there is also requirements for even capital buffer. So this comes very close to a banking regulation, like a full banking regulation. I would at least interpret this. And also one of the reasons why USDC debagged temporarily was, as I said, like Silicon Valley Bank. So it was the banking sector that drove stablecoin issuer into a DPEG. So I think this route is also sometimes a little bit overlooked in the sense. And I think so I wouldn't really say that, you know, this is not stable, because regulation exactly wants to get it stable, and I think it's doing a pretty good job here. I mean, the second point, and I think Michael, you alluded on that already a little, is that Lagarde is a little bit bearish on this monetary function, but on the technological side, she's more bullish, because she also sees the need for atomic settlement, for a cash leg on-chain, so fully aligned. She just prefers, let's say, other means of payment to do that and not stablecoins, which is namely what they want to do with their basically bringing central bank money on-chain via Appia on Pontes, right? So here, Lagarde sees the benefits, but just takes a different route, because obviously this is central bank initiative. So yeah, I really also would like to echo what you said, Max. I think in the end, it's also about competition, and you should foster competition, and you should, you know, launch different initiatives, and then the market should decide, you know, and the use case will develop, and the user in the end ultimately decides, as always. So I think it's good. The more, the better, in the sense. But yeah, it was interesting to hear this. I think it adds value to the debate, as you said, Michael, to differentiate it here, right? But and it's good part of the debate to have arguments in both directions, even if we seem to not fully to agree on all the arguments being made here, let's say.
I really enjoyed Max's point on putting the consumer benefits at the forefront and starting with it. I mean, in technology, that's a given. Yeah, it might even be the technology industry that in developing products puts consumers in the forefront. So again, starting on a green page, imagine a euro stablecoin that pays you interest on your balance, settles instantly, works 24/7, and costs nothing to send across borders globally. So isn't that what we all dream of? A money transmission like a WhatsApp message? And if I were Lagarde, or stated differently, my hope would have been that her first sentence in a speech is, what is the Champions League or the ideal scenario for any given European in payments? And everything is to be derived from that. Yeah, but she started with stable coins as one means or form of digital money, and only then at some point talked here and there about consumers. So to me, the starting point of any money and payments conversations always be the ideal dream scenario of what payments looks like globally. And only from there you derive technology requirements or design choices.
And I mean, from the argument from Liz Christine Lagarde, you can also interpret this that as she could see that stablecoins drive financial stability risks, you can also interpret that this means that the regulation is, from her perspective, not enough on stablecoins to preserve financial stability here. And that's also like a good segue into what the European Commission is now planning with the MiCA consultation. So, I mean, as you're listening to this podcast frequently, you know there is the MiCA regulation, Markets and Crypto Assets Regulation in Europe, basically since 2024, which was a major achievement to launch this regulation as kind of the first of its kind for a currency union. But of course, we also see changing environments, right? Stablecoins basically more and more increasing in importance, even if, as Max said, the dynamic is just not comparable to the US, not at all. We do see tokenization taking off. We do see AI and agentic payments. We also do see other global crypto regulation coming in, like Clarity Genius, we will talk about next as well. So there is a new environment coming up. And what now the Commission wants to do is wants to review MiCA's core building blocks on crypto assets, asset reference tokens, e-money tokens, general issuers, licensing requirements, etc., which I think is a very, very positive thing. Because what the Commission is doing, it asks the market for feedback on the current MiCA, actually in two formats. So a public consultation for broad stakeholder input and a more technical targeted consultation for industry participants and public authorities, which can be submitted by August 30 this year. So this means the Commission is seeking input from the market on how to improve MiCA, which I think is a great approach to talk to the market and then to improve so that maybe some of the things that are not working today can be improved. And also, just as a side note, as the Digital Euro Association, we are also contributing to that, bringing together different stakeholder groups like stablecoin issuers, crypto asset service providers, banks, and co. So if this is interesting, please feel free to reach out to also shape and bring the industry perspective to this consultation. Because again, I'm a really big fan of this collaborative approach and the transparency. And I think this is really a good news for the European space, if you ask me. Good, then looking at the time, let's come to the last topic of today before our knowledge bites, and we look at the UX, at the US, very similar word, look at the regulatory angle there. We know the Genius Act is in place, but we also know the Clarity Act is not yet in place. And Max, maybe you could share a little bit with us, you know, what's kind of the update on the Clarity, because there is a lot of back and forth. We discussed this in the podcast before, remuneration, yes, no, etc. So what did the last month bring us around the Clarity Act? Hopefully more clarity?
Yeah, that's still the hope, yet not completely sure. So Clarity Act, you already said that it's going to be what's supposed to be the second big framework coming out of the US that is focused on regulating crypto in a more broader sense. It's a huge undertaking because it tries to combine many different angles, from who has authority over crypto assets and what kind of crypto assets, to then downstream of that, what constitutes like a security, what constitutes like a commodity, how do you have to treat like DeFi, even tokenization. Now the stablecoin topic and stablecoin yield topic is also being like brought back into the conversation again. So it's a huge undertaking and something that I guess the current US administration has made a high priority of pushing through. There's been lots of, I guess, back and forth over the last 12 months on this. We've seen the House of Representatives pass their version of the Clarity Act a couple of months ago already. Now it's been the big topic of what the Senate is going to do. And then there was like positive news 2 weeks ago from the Senate Banking Committee, who in a bipartisan vote voted for passing of their crypto market structure bill, which is like a positive step forward. But still, Polymarket odds currently sit only at 55% that we will see Clarity Act being pushed through this year. And this is basically because now the framework that the Senate Banking Committee has passed and the version by the Agriculture Committee, they need to be now aligned. And there's also like open questions that still have to be worked through, especially when it comes to some ethics provisions inside the framework of basically not allowing like members of the administration to just launch widely some meme coins into the open, as we've seen.
Which could make sense.
Which is also like not totally like unfair, I guess. So this is something where, as this is like a bill that both parties have to agree on, or like at least some also Democrats have to agree on in order to pass this, where there's currently like still ongoing conversations on now consolidating this. And this is now becoming like a timing question, because we are basically moving towards the midterms at the end of the year in November. And then there's now like this very like tactical, I guess, approach and conversation inside the Senate of having to push this now through in the next weeks. Otherwise, it will become difficult again to put it back onto the map, because then there's more like other like political interests coming into place again. So this is basically now what's being worked through, and which is why the political market odds are only like at 55%, because it's not clear yet that it will get like a full Senate vote soon, and then also like a positive outcome on this vote. But if there was like a vote, the next steps would basically be that the Senate would pass it. Then we have the version of the House of the Representatives and the Senate that needs to be aligned, which is something that most observers don't consider to be like that difficult. So this would like, that would be something that is feasible. And then you have to vote on that again until finally it reaches the president's desk for signature. So this is currently what's going on. Again, the big open topic on how to bring in the provisions on the ethics side. And yeah, everybody's observing what's happening here on a daily basis.
You know, Clarity Act, the bit that really stands out to me, again, talking very broadly about it, is really the shift in the US policy strategy. That is that we've gone from, should crypto be regulated in the first place and by whom, to now, what kind of market structure should the US actually build? And I just totally understand that a major democracy for a new asset class and a new economy, the token economy, if you will, just needs a time to work it through precisely. Yeah. So by now we have a much more mature conversation than during Jerry Gensler times. The committee vote was bipartisan, which is a positive signal. The new draft looks more industry friendly, and the White House is dreaming, funnily, of a July 4th crypto independence day. But besides all of these positive aspects, I'd stay sober here, really, because Polymarket has it around 70%, which is not total anticipation of a get through this year. And the full Senate needs 60 votes, and there's still the whole reconciliation dance with the House. So my take is that it's real momentum for and behind the Clarity Act now, but it's not a done deal. But once the US has both genius and clarity on the books, the pressure on Europe to move gets very real, because then even our regulatory advantage is no longer true.
I think just for everybody who's not that deep into the weeds of clarity and so on, I think just like one important thing to understand why this matters. It's basically because it gives the US market and US companies like really long-term clarity on how to play in this market. As of now, you could say, given the very constructive US administration and the regulatory bodies, it's not as critical, basically, because the SEC and CFTC and the other agencies will just basically bend existing regulation and give out own guidance as they see fit. And currently they take a very constructive view on the market, which allows all these like initiatives to be like pushed forward. But that could change with the next administration. And this is why it becomes critical to not make it like dependent on the mood and the political view of the current administration and the regulatory bodies, but something that is independent of that.
So this means the Clarity Act not fully clear yet. And yeah, it will definitely be something we have to monitor for the next couple of months if, yeah, Polymarket odds indicating that could come this year or not. It's kind of in the stars. So let's see, but we will definitely monitor and keep you posted. Thanks, Max, for this overview on what is happening in the US.
Right, Max, Jonas, as our listeners most likely will not stop consuming digital assets and digital money content after this episode, let's recommend some knowledge bites that may serve exactly that purpose to further deep dive into this fascinating world of digital money and digital assets. Jonas, what would be your pick for our listeners to further consume content?
Yeah, so I brought a knowledge bite today. It's actually just a very simple LinkedIn post, and it's by the European Central Bank on the digital euro, because interestingly, discussed that in this podcast as well, banks and payment service provider could apply for the digital euro pilot, which will take place, as we discussed before in this episode, mid-2027 to mid-2028. And that was the deadline in May. And the ECB announced that more than 50 payment service providers across Europe applied to participate in the pilot. And I think that's pretty interesting because I was actually positively surprised by this amount. I thought it would be less. I think 50 is a really strong number, and yeah, really curious to see. So it really seems that also the market more and more takes the digital euro as an initiative that is now here and works together on the topic with the ECB and not anymore fights it. That's at least somehow my interpretation of this amount of 50. But yeah, let's see. In July, there will be the list published of who will be accepted. So then we know names, which is also very interesting. But at least the number 50 is at least something that I found very interesting. And we will keep and put the link to this post in the show notes.
Thanks so much. Definitely add it to my list.
I'm completely shameless here and give a plug for our own reports that we just put out. So we just published, or we're about to publish a second report. We already published like one report, but I can, I guess, shill both of them here. The first one that we have already published is a report on the Spanish ecosystem. We just did an event in Madrid and it was super interesting. It was the very first time that we were in Spain, and it really paid off because we have like a very institutional-led market by banks like Santander, BBVA, Caixa, and so on. And it's also, I guess, no surprise that we've seen like 5 Spanish banks being part of the Qivalis consortium. So they're really like driving the market forward. And on the other hand, you also have like a quite interesting fintech tokenization ecosystem. And we basically interviewed over 8 people that are super deep entrenched in the Spanish digital assets ecosystem, and published a report about all the intricacies and unique properties about the market. So for everyone who's like interested in understanding like what's happening in Spain, I guess this is like a go-to report. And then I think like next Monday or Tuesday, we will publish a report on institutional crypto lending. So this is also a very interesting trend that we now see early signs of takeoff, where you have these decentralized lending protocols underneath, and now very institutional counterparties on top that directly engage in borrowing and lending activities through very regulated entities like Asignum, for instance, who just launched such an offering with Falcon X. So we take a deeper look into this emerging trend of institutional-grade decentralized crypto lending.
Michael, what did you bring?
Yeah, so I brought an IMF paper on stablecoins titled Making Stablecoins Stable. It's an IMF working paper number 2026-74. It's, of course, linked in the show notes too. And it's worth your time, really, because first, look to the authors, Bouli, Mikoli, Tsang. That's basically, for those who don't know, the IMF's A-team on digital money. And when these folks publish together, regulators really read it, and I read it too. I enjoyed it. Yeah, what's clever is they take the classic Diamond Dibvig bank run model from 1983 and apply it to stablecoins, which basically says, stop treating stablecoins like some weird crypto thing, which in the perception of many media outlets and consumers out there, it is. But actually, they can be conceptualized as banks and they can run like banks and therefore are subject to potential bank runs. And this is why you can apply this classic Diamond Dibvig bank run model. Yeah. So the bottom line of the paper really is this is going to be the paper everyone cites in the next round of stablecoin regulation discussions. I already see it anticipating. So read it now or hear it quoted at you in 3 to 6 months when banks have their next round of stablecoin evaluations.
Now I have flashback, Michael, for my economics masters, because Diamond Dibvig model is something we looked at. So great that I extend this by stablecoins. That's cool.
So even on the academic side, crypto and traditional finance are growing together. Excellent. So I enjoyed our today's recording a lot. Thank you guys for making it to the end, for listening to BFRR. And thank you, Jonas and Max, for your takes and your insights. To our listeners, if you enjoy the podcast, please recommend us and rate us. That has proven to help us the most. Do connect with us on YouTube, LinkedIn, and particularly our expert community on Telegram, which are available both in German and English. Visit our website for more detailed analysis and very detailed show notes, and do make sure to subscribe. Until then, this is BFRR, bringing Europe's perspective on digital money and digital assets to the world.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.